Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. In 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards. And alongside me today, folks, we got Tim Tascornia, the CEO of CHOB. Tim, my man, thanks for coming on the program today.
Kevin, thanks so much for having me. Super excited to be here today.
It's always great to have a fellow surfer and water sporter on the program today. Tim, if we can't catch you on a podcast, I hear we can catch you outside of a freighter coming into Seattle port. Tell me a little bit about the water sports there going on in Seattle.
Yeah, if you're not finding me on this podcast and not kicking around the offices at CHOB, most of the time you're going to find me on the water. So I'm an avid, there's this new sport. It's not that new. It's been around for 4 years. It's called foiling. There's a lot of different disciplines to it. Wake foil, wing foil, tow-in foil. Of course, there's e-foils as well. But yeah, up here in Seattle, our favorite thing to do is to pull into a freighter wave and ride it for a couple miles. And if there aren't any freighters available, we'll find a tugboat and tow into their wave.
I just love the mindset. I mean, you got to make do with what you can. And, you know, for people listening to this, I mean, Seattle isn't necessarily known as a surf town. Of course, they have surfing on the Pacific Ocean if you wanted to venture out there. But that may be a theme in kind of the episode today with CHOB. I mean, making do with what you have. I mean, it's an incredible, innovative structure, incredible, innovative, I guess, system that you all have built. Tell us before you talk about the technicalities, the origin story with the founder. How did this idea come to be?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Well, I have to come back to Seattle being Surf City off foiling. You know, who would think we could do that? But I digress. To talk about CHOB in terms of the origin of it, the founder of it, I'm the CEO, I'm not the founder. The founder started the company about 10 years ago. He actually started studying anaerobic digestion when he was an undergraduate several decades ago. And for him, it was this process of just looking at how do you take something that otherwise would have been a waste, that emits greenhouse gases, that consumes space in our landfills, and turn that into something useful in terms of an energy. And so for those of you who don't know what anaerobic digestion is, it's been around for thousands of years. And it's really the easiest way to think of it is think of our units as a mechanical cow. And so, you know, any type of organic matter that goes in there, we focus on food waste, goes in and through a digestion process where that cow might have let out methane and other things up front and the back, we capture that and we process it and turn it into renewable energy. And in addition to that, this was pretty surprising to me, the water content in typical food is quite high. And so we get this biofertilizer out the other side of the process as well. And that biofertilizer is really rich with microbes and nutrients for the soil. And so with that, you can revitalize soil. So when you take a product that says, I'll take your waste, your food waste that otherwise would have gone into a landfill and turn it into a valuable resource, that was intriguing. So he started the process with the company and wanted to figure out how to miniaturize it so that we could put our units at the source of food waste. So a lot of anaerobic digestion you might have heard of before or seen might be attached to a dairy farm. And in a dairy farm scenario, you do have some odor control issues, but it is a dairy farm and there is manure that's exposed, you know, anyways. But if we want to put these units at the source where food waste is created, they have to have best in class odor control. And so we spent a lot of time innovating around odor control and so that we could be able to deploy these things in urban and suburban environments. And we made a modular. so that you can put them in really easily without a lot of site work and other preparations, so they could get deployed quickly and people can start making progress against their greenhouse gas goals.
Incredible. And of course, anaerobic digestion, meaning no oxygen, of course. And for anyone who's learned about methane, you'll know that cows, they have four stomachs, actually. It's very interesting to kind of learn about the process and how that happens. But the incredible innovation here, again, turning food waste into energy or into a fertilizer, something that can be used again, the overhead costs have to be very, very low. Of course, you're either getting the food waste donated. Tell me a little bit more about maybe the facilities that you target or that have purchased these modular, again, these look like things that would be on a freight train that you're probably riding outside of coming into the South. Tell me more about kind of what this looks like so someone listening to this can understand.
Yeah. Yeah. So our form factor, physically what our units look like, our smaller ones, we have two product lines. One is the mini and we have the core. For the mini, those are intermodal containers. And as you mentioned, Kevin, that's like, if you saw a freighter going by or a train going by, that container that's holding all the goods there is an intermodal container. We use single use intermodal containers. So we repurpose that for our product line and that gets dropped onto the site. For our cores, we actually use repurposed frac tanks for our digestion. And when you mentioned those different stomachs of the cow, that's what we're using those frac tanks for on our larger units. And so our customer base, really think about anybody who produces a decent amount of food waste. So for example, for the New York Housing Authority, for NYCHA, we're approved as a vendor there for urban and suburban deployment on their units. One of our units is attached to a tofu factory. And so just on an island outside of Seattle here called Vashon Island, a tofu factory, when you create tofu, you have a byproduct of okara and whey. And so we have an automated feeder that accepts their okara and whey, feeds it into our anaerobic digestion unit, and it has a period inside that unit of about 30 days where we digest it, continuously fed and continuously harvested for biogas and fertilizer. That biogas there gets refined to become renewable natural gas and blended behind the meter. So the tofu factory will offset what they would have been using for fossil fuels with the RNG produced by that. And that biofertilizer gets used by 30 different farms on the island to help them grow organic goods. And so that fertilizer is certified organic in the state of Washington, and it's rich with microbial content. And so food processors really benefit from it. We also have deployments down UCSD, down California, near you, Kevin, college campuses, corporate campuses. We actually have a deal that we closed with a regional utility that wanted to increase the renewable natural gas capacity. It's a company called National Grid, and that unit will be deployed outside of Boston at Essex Vocational School in a couple months.
I love that. And Tim, you know, I'm going to ask you the question that, you know, any good salesperson or someone, you know, pitching needs to answer, which is, you know, what's in it for them? Right. If I think about, you know, a university or, you know, someone that is really intrigued by this idea, I mean, are they just purchasing it to, you know, offset their natural gas fees? What's the return on investment for them?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I'm going to answer the second part of your question first, and I'll come back to the first part.
Okay. Take it down.
Because there are people who get interested in this because it's the right thing to do. You know, to take food waste and to turn it into energy and to not haul it away and not put it into a landfill is just the right thing to do. But ultimately, it always has to go past the procurement officer's desk. It has to make financial sense. And so the payback period on our units with the current government incentives is around 2 to 3 years. And without those government incentives, it's about 5 to 6 years. The typical driver in terms of why somebody is going to want to do this is because they've set their ESG goals. They want to reduce their carbon footprint. We're talking to some arenas that have made a zero carbon footprint commitment, and they want to be able to communicate that. Well, guess what happens if some of their food waste gets contamination in it? Pieces of plastic or something like that. It goes to the landfill, and then they can no longer make their zero carbon footprint claim. And so for us to take anaerobic digestion into that facility for them where they have full control over it, they're able to be true to their claims and to be able to achieve that. And so, you know, typically what is going to begin the start of interest in CHOMP in one of our units is going to be that commitment to do the right thing. And then ultimately we work with them and say, what's going to be the best use, highest and best use of that biogas? You know, do you want to actually create electricity? We have a food bank here in Seattle and a university district food bank that we'll be deploying shortly. And for them, I mean, this is just a beautiful story. They have vans that they want to be able to charge, you know, and so we have a fuel cell separate, a hydrogen separator that goes into a fuel cell that allows them to top off their EVs. Those electric vehicles go out, pick up their donations, and they bring them back. The best donations that you get, there's always going to be spoilage. That spoilage goes into the digester and gives them that energy. Then they have a rooftop garden. And so they use the biofertilizer that comes off to grow products to give to their people at the food bank. And that's in downtown Seattle. So our odor control has to be best in class for them to use it. And then different gardens around the Seattle area, they're called pea patch gardens, will actually use some of this biofertilizer to grow organic goods. And so the circular nature of this solution is something that people are really drawn to. You know, in Vashon, the fact that we have these farmers that are seeing 20% higher yields on this organic biofertilizer that we're providing to them is something that just, it creates a circular story, reducing waste and allows people to really move closer to their goals.
So just so I have the model right, is the revenue coming from the modular purchasing at these units, but it's also coming from, you know, reselling the fertilizer and the natural gas and whatever other byproduct that you know comes from this station?
Yeah. So the value streams with these units are typically it's several. One is hauling and tipping fees, and so they're no longer paying hauling and tipping fees. The other one is that displacement of fossil fuels. And so they have savings associated with that. And then there's carbon credits. And so depending on the use of the product, they have carbon credits that they can monetize, or they can use for internal carbon goals if they want to claim them. You know, and then you also have a biofertilizer, which is a value. So these value streams come together that more than pay for them to be able to move forward with the purchase.
That makes for your customers, right? I guess. I was talking about more for you. That makes sense. No worries. So it's incredible to see that you've already had proof of concept. I mean, there are a lot of individuals and companies. I mean, we have a few people who are in kind of the modular space and are working on reducing the carbon emissions with travel and producing things locally. I mean, there's a lot of different innovative models that are coming out here, which I think says a lot about where we're maybe going, you know, as a sustainable economy. But to get to where you are, you've had to overcome, I'm sure, so many challenges and hurdles to get this adoption. Tell us a little bit more about the story to get this to scale, to get this prototype ready. I'm sure you had to be pre-revenue for a long time. Like, what was that journey like for you all?
Yeah, you know, it is... I think any startup, you have moments and highs and lows. And the interesting thing about startups is those moments between are really short. The high and the low can come literally back to back or hour, you know, day to day, hour to hour. But you know, it's really a strength of commitment and direction in terms of vision of where we wanted to drive. And it was, and I'll credit Jan Allen, he's our founder, who had the idea that he wanted to create these things. And finding customers who were interested and were willing to pay a little bit. So we weren't necessarily pre-revenue. A lot of the research that we did to be able to build these out was pre-revenue, but our model has always been finding progressive, innovative customers who are ready to take a bit of a risk and go ahead and invest. Again, because they have a shared perspective of this food waste going into landfills was the wrong thing to do. And so, you know, we have about 14 units that have gone out this year. At the start of this year, we've closed on 3 new units. So we're actively building those right now. So 2024 is going to be a big year for us. 2023 was a year of where we really built out our pipeline, which stands at over 150 million of opportunity right now. And 2024 is going to be about converting that over. And so that process, as we found those progressive customers who are willing to learn in, we learned alongside of them. And it's one of those things that, you know, as you develop our technology, we do have a couple patents, but a lot of what we have are trade secrets. And that's something that you build by having operational hours. And so, you know, we're in excess of 100,000 operation hours now, which has allowed us really to have deeper insights into the product that we're creating. And we've been fortunate enough to have customers that it becomes more of a living lab for us. You know, we actively work on that plant that we actually own that's attached to the tofu factory. And that's where we do a lot of our prototype work. And we're always making refinements to it.
I love that. And it's certainly, you know, I'm in the same business in the sense that, you know, we're always looking for values aligned CEOs and customers, right? Who understand it's not all just about, you know, the bottom line. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about sustain that bottom line and be ahead of the curve. And I think business has always been innovative in that sense. I think business is really the only sector. It's the only community that can fulfill the needs of society. I mean, we cannot rely on government or nonprofits to sustain, you know, the challenges that this world faces. It's got to come from this for-profit sector. So it's those businesses and partners and NGOs and, of course, education that you talked about earlier that are really driving this difference and taking that risk and making that challenge. For you, on your dashboard, Tim, as a CEO, you're in the helm, you know, you're in the boat, right? You're kind of looking at your dashboard. What are the three key things, if you don't mind sharing, you can say, you can be broad about this, that you're really prioritizing right now? Because you've got scarce resources and you need to prioritize those things.
Yeah. So for me, in terms of the dashboard, one is the health of our manufacturing organization. You know, I always want to know from looking at from a day in and a day out, I want to understand what our exit velocity is for the products that we're building. And it's just at the end of the day, we're a manufacturing company. I have to know that. The second thing that I'm looking at is cash, always. And, you know, when you look at that input exit in terms of cash in and cash out, nothing kills a startup more quickly than poor cash management. And the third thing, this one's a little bit more difficult, is the health of the organization from an individual perspective. And that is not technically the third thing on my dashboard, but something I'd look at and I think about all the time. Because ultimately, an organization is only as strong as the people who are in it. And so, you know, my top priority is always understanding what the relative health is of the individuals inside the company. And you brought up this shared value with our customers. We have a shared set of values as a company. There's reasons why each individual came and joined Chomp. For me, you know, before we came on this, you and I talked about it. Like, I'm an outdoors person. I'm a waterman. I love scuba and surfing and foiling, and I ski and I snowboard sometime. I have 3 daughters. And for me, where I feel closest to, not to go off the chart here or anything, but, you know, where I'm most spiritual, where I feel closest to the environment that we live in, it's when I'm in a lineup, when I'm surfing. It's when I'm in the mountains. And for me, the priority to leave something a little bit better for my kids so that they can enjoy that and their kids can enjoy that, that's the reason that I joined Chomp. And so if you go through the values of all our team members at Chomp, you know, they all have their reason. For me, it's those outdoors. For MZ, who's our chief experience officer, it's gardening. For Andy, who's our VP of R&D, it's rock climbing, mountain climbing. So we have these shared values in terms of why we're doing what we're doing. And then we have shared values for how we do the work that we're doing. And for me as a CEO, to be checking in somewhat constantly to make sure that the way that we're approaching the work is consistent with the core values of our organization is critical. So it's a softer third one than the other two, but I watch it. The fourth one that probably is more the technical third one that you're looking for is sales pipeline. You know, I'm always watching that sales pipeline in terms of what's happening at all different levels of it. We're a relatively young organization. And so for us, understanding what our sales cycle is really important. We don't have perfect knowledge to that right now. And so we just need to watch it and improve it. But I gave you three. I put the fourth one in there, but that's actually the fourth one. The third one around values and how we're getting our work done is the most important. Because life's short and you don't have that many opportunities to work on really, really great companies like this. So I want to make sure our people are getting the most out of it.
Yeah. And tell me more about that values alignment. I mean, this exercise that maybe how you came up with the values, because, you know, there's two types of leaders, right? Like you could come in and just say, hey, like here are our values and, you know, instill them and base them off of experience. But if you don't get buy-in from the team, then the values don't really mean anything. I mean, how did you come up with these values? Are they one word? Are they punchy? Are they kind of like a mantra? Like, tell me how you came up with these.
Yeah, I'll walk you through the process, and then I don't mind sharing, you know, what the actual values are. It is interesting, and it's insightful of you to bring up the fact that you could just come in, and I had a pretty good idea. Like, these are the values that I would like to do. Then I had to realize it's not all about me. And so what we did is we had a cross-disciplinary team throughout the organization. So a representative from each part of the organization. We have a unique environment where some of our people go into the office every day. We have people working remote. So mixing both work modality together with discipline inside the organization, we had a team of five who went forth and crafted our values and started working on them. So I gave them some rough guidelines, but then they drove that process with periodic check-ins. And you know, the result that they came out with was better than what I would have come up with myself. It just was. And the beautiful thing about it is that through that process, you know, this happened over about a four-month period. They would meet on a weekly basis and then have some individual time. And there's always a little bit of tension in the group as somebody feels more passionately about one area or another. So it's a great way for these interdisciplinary folks to build actually relationships with each other as they go through that. But what you come out with is a set of values that people really, really believe in and it embodies. You know, I'll just share them with you, you know, quickly, one of which was powerful together, you know, and I'm going to read this right off the thing. We come from different backgrounds and bring unique experiences, skills, and perspectives to our work. We value authenticity, celebrate diversity of thought, promote collaboration to achieve our goals. We work together, win together, and grow together.
Mm.
That's powerful together. The other one that the team came up with was constant curiosity. You know, we're critical thinkers. We value learning and growth. I won't read them all to you. And problem solving, but, you know, constant curiosity. Another one I was really happy they came up with was ownership. You know, we are all, we provide stock options to our employees. We're all owners of the company and we act as owners as a company, you know, and that's everything from how we decide to use company resources to, you know, we don't play a blame game. Like if it's ours, we'll own it. We'll move forward. And then the last one is intentional urgency. And that just recognizes the fact that, you know, we're working towards a more sustainable future, but time's limited. And so we're super intentional with our energy. Looks like somebody didn't like the intentional urgency one. That's okay. Feel free to, you know, put it out there. I actually really, at least for me, it it goes into, you know, an overall feeling in terms of, you know, we don't have a lot of time. You know, if you look at our overall lifespan, and this is whether you're out in nature doing the things that you want to do, whatever you enjoy to do, but on a business, it's the same thing. You know, you have a limited amount of resources, and so you're smart about how you push forward, but you do use your time really wisely.
I think that's great. Again, I don't know how that thumb sign came up for those listening to this. I had a little glitch here. The values are not up for debate right now. They are solidified, just to clarify. But I think that's really powerful. I think it's really helpful just for anyone listening to this to kind of get an understanding of, like, one, obviously how clearly passionate you are about the values. But two, like, I noticed in my experience that when our team came together and said, hey, essentially we don't like the values that you created, you know, we want to create our own. I didn't have a problem with that on the spot. We just kind of went through an exercise. And now what I'm seeing is everyone is just like, you know, they keep bringing it up in meetings and in, you know, validating decisions and choices with the values, that they can become very powerful.
Well, and that's, it sounds like you did a great job, because when those values slip in and become the lexicon, you know, use words inside of your day-to-day work, that's when you know you really achieved it and you achieved it well. So good for you. And
well,
for us, it's something that provides a nice, you know, guiding light for us, you know, in our team.
I'm glad to hear you're experiencing the same thing. And again, just trying to say that if it's helpful to anyone else listening out there. And now, I guess, kind of bringing this like full circle now, you know, you've got these values, of course, that are kind of driving the culture here. You know, the focus, of course, in this stage is on all the things you mentioned, but also sales and adoption is a part of that. But at the end of the day, the shared value approach of, you know, doing the right thing, being foresighted, leaving things far better than you found it. At the end of the day, Tim, like, what is impact to you? What does that mean?
Yeah. So from an impact perspective, it's probably useful just to hear a little bit more about why I, in addition to wanting to leave the world in a better place for my kids, why I got involved. And it's one of those things where you look at anaerobic digestion, you look at renewable natural gas, and there's a good amount of industry growth in that area. And when you look at that and you put it together with the amount of inbound interest that we were getting, we have the opportunity to build a $1 billion business. There's an opportunity to actually take this thing that is good for the environment, good for people, it's the right thing to do, but it also is a massive market opportunity. For me, that's really interesting, because when you look at impact, eventually you want to see some level of scale. You know, and all of us have different skill sets and different ideas of what impact means and the scale for which we're going to be able to deliver that impact. For me, I like looking at large scale opportunities that, when they're successful, can have a very, very meaningful impact. And when I say impact, yes, with the business that we're in, it's predominantly to the environment. You know, we're going to pull down greenhouse gases and have a very big impact on that. But we're also going to have a positive impact on the lives of our employees, the people who are in the communities that we go into, you know, who actually get to benefit from. I mean, I don't know how much time, I know we're not probably going to get into this around our food systems, but to take away synthetic fertilizers and be able to use an organic biofertilizer to grow our foods, the impact that can have when people eat better food, I would be honored as a custodian of this company if we were able to get more, you know, if we were able to get more organic fertilizer and good food out there for people to eat, you know, while at the same time providing us a source of energy off of a wasted product. And so impact to me, grow the company, have it be wildly successful, because we're going to impact the environment that way. We're going to impact the lives where each one of our units goes, and we're going to impact the lives of our employees.
Tim, I just, one of the things I picked up on there is, you know, you referred yourself as a custodian, and I've heard that a lot, you know, in the kind of the impact CEO sphere. Is that what you kind of see your role as, or what do you see maybe your role as CEOs?
I see my role as basically do everything and anything that needs to get done that people may or may not want to do. And I'll tell you this, it's actually what I love about this particular company and this team and this opportunity. I mean, you'll see, I've had a welder in my hand, only responsibly. I don't know how to weld, but the guys showed me, you know, the team down there showed me how to do it. Shovels, you know, I'm shoveling biofilter in and I'm filling it up. And when sometimes we need to do some grinding in terms of like, you know, work on the products, I love this blend of physical as well as, you know, traditional office work. And, you know, my role is everything from a cheerleader, you know, to help people get what they need to get done and to fill gaps. You know, we're a small team, you know, small organization, you know, and when you're going through a period of growth and evolution as a team, to me, my role is to do the things that other people don't have time to do or don't want to do so that they can continue doing the things that are important for the organization. Now, as a CEO, you're always going to have the overhead responsibilities that you have to have, you know, around fundraising, around, you know, the things I mentioned around, you know, operational management and good corporate hygiene so that we can continue to be successful as we want to be. But, you know, also being somebody who's going to step in and do work whenever it's needed, wherever it's needed. And, you know, when we talk about culture, at least here at Chomp, it's interesting. One of the individuals who is interviewing for a position, you know, with us, we had to paint one of our containers. So, you know where that interview was? It was down at our manufacturing facility in Auburn with paint in his hand. Because we want to know, is that person going to be a person who's going to go pick up a broom and sweep it out when it needs, you know, sweep the floor when it needs to get done? And right. Do whatever it needs. And for us and our culture, that's important. And you don't get that if you have somebody in my position who's not willing to do that themselves.
Right. People who kind of do whatever it takes, right? No matter how much they're getting paid, no matter what the title is, it doesn't matter. You know, yeah. It's team above themselves.
I get that. And I've always been more of a fan of whether it's real or perceived, flat organizations, because it just provides people a lot more ownership for their different areas and accountability. And to me, that just, it increases more connection to the company because they know that they get to make decisions, mm-hmm. You know, and it's one of those things that, not to be a cliche, because you hear this too, but, you know, I certainly don't, if somebody makes a mistake, that's not a problem. If they make a mistake and they deny it or they don't fix it, that's a problem. But I want our team to feel comfortable taking risks and making mistakes, admitting them. And so, you know, it's one of the things I make mistakes. And when I make them, I own them and I share them with the team because I want them to do the same thing. And so, you know, to the extent that I can help model those activities so that people feel okay, that they're in a safe space to perform at their best. That's the culture and environment I really want to drive.
I love that. And of course we can learn from our mistakes, but I'm just like out of curiosity, just like with the CEOs we have on the program, like where else are you learning right now? Like, do you have a piece of advice? It could be a book, it could be a mentor, it could be a program you went through. Is there something that has been very beneficial to you in your career that you would recommend to the audience today?
It's interesting. The learning that I do tends to be a little bit different than I do read. And for me, just because I'm in this zone right now that, I'm very concerned about just like, the health and lifestyle that we live and the foods that we eat. You know, I just read Ultra Processed People. Yeah, I read another book by Peter Attia called Outlive. Those things are interesting in terms of context. For me, learning is about being present and trying new things. And like we were talking about foiling before we came on the show, for me, it's amazing how much you learn in that. I've learned a ton. I'm a musician. Don't laugh. I'm actually in a
you do everything.
I'm in a band. We're pretty good, but we're a cover band, so everybody always has some level of perspective on that. But I will tell you, I learned so much through the level of vulnerability that I feel when I stand on stage, because I'm not a good musician. I'm mediocre at best. And so when I'm up there, that feeling in terms of just vulnerability for me earlier on in my career, I felt that it was much better to have a harder persona to drive, to show confidence, to not show weakness. And as I've evolved, and a lot of times, whether that's learning process on foiling, whether that's getting up in front of people on stage, trying to play music, that willingness to open up yourself and show some levels of vulnerability opens up so many different avenues for learning. And for me, that wasn't something that was, you know, through a particular book or a session or something like that. It was just kind of through that life experience. And trying to be present enough to realize that that was the door that I was opening up for myself at that time. I know that's not the best answer in terms of what you're looking for, but that's at least what has worked for me.
No. That's a definitely a core quality that a lot of these CEOs have in common, and or entrepreneurs, really just successful individuals, is, you know, being able to try something new and start all over, that learning process all over again. It doesn't matter. That's why it doesn't matter if you fail, you know, because you're going to be able to just, you know, live in humility and start from the bottom all over again, because, you know, that's how you learn and that's what you want to do. And so whether you're starting to be a surfer, or, you know, you're starting your grunge rock band called Nirvana in Seattle, you know, it's going to take some time. You're going to have to overcome a lot of nerves, but that is life, and that's growing. That's a learning mindset. And I think that's really beautiful, Tim. So in all of this, bring this home. What is your definition of a real leader?
When I look at leaders that I admire, and I look at the characteristics that they have, it is an individual that finds a way to endear themselves to others and help them achieve those others, help them achieve more than they would have done by themselves. And so it is that through inspiring, nurturing, and coaching those around them to be more successful than they ever could have been without that leader there. That's the definition for me of a real leader.
Tim Tisconia, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, empower other leaders, and always keep it real. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Hey, Real Leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.